Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Secrets of the White House in Your Brain. Scientists are reevaluating the way they look at the brain. There's new hope that breakthroughs will be made for paralysis, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, dementia, and all brain-related diseases. And in this audio interview with R. Douglas Fields, Ph.D., author of The Other Brain, you'll hear all about it. Dr. Fields says all brain science has previously been based on what's called neuron doctrine, the stuff we all learned in biology about neurons, synapses, and electrical transmission. But do you remember anything about glial cells? Doctors always knew they were there, but they kind of just discarded them away as white matter. As it turns out, the white matter matters a lot. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about this amazing discovery in neuroscience, the aha moment that turned everything around and why everybody is so excited about it. You'll also hear about a hard look at the way science is funded and how that can stifle even the most promising of research. You'll hear exactly what glial cells do and specific examples of the kinds of glial research that could help everything from brain cancer to schizophrenia. You'll also learn a little-known fact that the brain has its own immune system, and glial cells are the first responders. Find out what all that means and how it works. You'll hear the surprising relationship exercise has on brain function and memory. You'll hear the bad guy role glial cells can play in brain cancer, learning disabilities, psychological disorders, and more. You'll also hear how glial cells are expanding our knowledge of learning and the interesting changes that happen into your brain after it learns to play an instrument or juggle. Could glial cell research have cured Senator Ted Kennedy's brain cancer? Dr. Fields says scientists are definitely playing catch-up when it comes to brain research because they ignored more than half of the brain for so long. Glia makes up 85% of the cells in the brain, and in this audio interview, you'll hear the amazing things that 85% can do. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Today we have Dr. Fields with us. So, Dr. Fields, you've written The Other Brain book, and this is just exciting stuff, and we are just so glad that you could be with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
How did you get interested in this field? You have some remarkable stories in there.
I'm one of those fortunate people who always knew what they wanted to do. I always wanted to be a scientist from an early age, and I loved biology, and the brain was particularly intriguing to me. I mean, it defines who we are, all our memories and perceptions and skills and dreams, and how does it work?
How long have you been doing brain research?
Well, I've been at the National Institutes of Health for 23 years, but my whole professional career has been brain neuroscience research, although I started out as a marine biologist there in California at Scripps and also Moss Landing. I studied shark brains.
Dr. Fields, one of the things with The Other Brain book, one of the reasons it's so interesting is you talk about how this is a unique moment in the history of brain science and how this is just revolutionizing what we've traditionally thought about how the brain works. And, you know, for all of our listeners, what have we thought about how the brain works?
I'm glad you sensed that because in the book, I really hope people would understand this excitement that we're feeling because the book is packed with information and medical information. But really, this is a new dimension in brain function, an emerging idea about how the brain works. So that's exciting. And I've heard about these revolutions, much like realizing the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. We read about those. But to have one happening in real time is very exciting. So in the past, all of our ideas about how the brain worked were based on something called the neuron doctrine. And that was that all information in the nervous system and computation takes place by electrical transmission of impulses through neurons communicating across synapses. And what we've now discovered is that that fundamental assumption is not correct, that there is another form of information flow in the brain that doesn't involve neurons.
And so you actually discovered in the laboratory, you watched these glia cells, is what they're called. You discovered a lot of this, right?
Well, yes, I made a lot of contributions, but so did many others. It's been a real dawning of new understanding. I should say that I think everybody's fascinated by how the brain works and how neurons can allow us to do all the things that our brain does, but only 15% of the cells in our brain are neurons. And so the glial cells, which means glue, have been largely overlooked because they don't make electricity. And it was work in the lab, new techniques forced us to rethink our fundamental assumptions and realize that there is information flow outside of neurons and through non-electrical mechanisms. And this is what I'm calling the other brain, the glial part of the brain.
Basically, the glia has a tremendous amount of work that it does in the brain. And as I recall, I remember learning about this, we won't say how many years ago, but you know, just kind of that it didn't do much, that it sat there.
Right. Well, it's left out of the textbooks. I mean, I'm sure all of your listeners have seen pictures of synapses on Zoloft commercials or textbooks. They never show the glia. The glia are 85% of the brain in terms of cell numbers, and they're tightly surrounding the synapses. So they were ignored because they were just felt to be structural packing material and serving mundane functions like cleaning up after neurons and maintaining the environment around neurons with the proper potassium and ion concentrations and feeding neurons and removing the neurotransmitters after neurons release them. And they do all those things. They're also understood to be involved in disease. But the other shoe never dropped, that this puts glia in a position of control. Glia can control synapses. And we can see how important our glia are in diseases, but we didn't stop to realize that, geez, if they're that important in disease, they might be doing something in normal brain function.
And, you know, Dr. Fields, that brings up an interesting question. Why was this ignored?
That's the question that I'm confronted with in writing this book. How did we overlook half the brain for 100 years? Well, first of all, the eyes see what the mind is prepared to comprehend. We were taught as neuroscientists that neurons did it all. And even though six times as many cells in the brain were right there looking at us, we didn't see them. The neurons were like celebrities in a faceless crowd. And so we just ignored them, had little interest. Secondly, we were using the wrong tools for the job. And their neuroscientists use microelectrodes to record electrical activity in neurons. And I did that myself, and we still do. But electrodes are deaf to the communication that glia cells are involved in because glia don't use electricity. And then the third thing is the scientific establishment sort of suppressed the development of this new idea. And this is nothing sinister. This is always the way it is in science. An idea is thought to be not very important, so it doesn't compete well for grant funding, doesn't get published in major journals. Other scientists don't hear about it. The scientists who work on these kind of unimportant cells are not highly esteemed, so this really suppresses the development of a field. And it's always this way in any revolution in science, so that's one of the delights to look back and see how that's happened.
And who decides how it's not important?
Science is very collaborative, and it's a sophisticated social interaction. If you discover something, it's really not science until it is validated and communicated in scientific journals around the world, and there's a big process for that. There's also a process for granting money to do research. You have to convince a committee that what you want to do is important, and they have very limited funding.
So you've got to be good at spreading the idea, and you've got to be good at getting the money.
That's right. That's right. And
okay.
So what happened in this field is eventually like-minded scientists got together. We started a new journal, scientific journal, Neuroglia Biology. And then there was a place to publish this work. And then slowly, as the experiments progress and people learn about it, then the field merges. And that's what's happening.
In your book, The Other Brain Book, which if people want to find more out about it, they can go to theotherbrainbook.com. That's by R. Douglas Fields, a researcher at the NIH. The glial cells, their role has tremendous implications for so many diseases that cause so much suffering for people. Cancer, MS, HIV, psychiatric illnesses. Dr. Fields, can you talk a little bit about what does this mean for some of these illnesses?
Well, you're right. It touches almost every neurological illness and brain function. And maybe before going into that, to give a little preparation, I should say that the important concepts to get across about this revolution in glia is three discoveries. And that is that glia can monitor neurons, so they can sense neural activity. Secondly, glia communicate. And third, glia control neurons. So what you have is glia have the same neurotransmitter receptors that neurons have, which is a mystery. Why would they have neurotransmitter receptors? Well, it turns out that they use those receptors to sense the neurotransmitter released at synapses. And then glia can communicate with each other by using chemical signaling. This allows them to pick up a signal from eavesdropping on neural activity, communicate through a glial network, and then they can also release neurotransmitters, the same ones neurons do. So now they can control another synapse in a part of the brain that may not even be hardwired together. So that is the new dimension of brain function that glia gives us. And from that, we can then begin to understand how disease could be so relevant to glia, because so many of our ideas about neurological illness are based on synaptic function. All of our drugs to treat neurological illnesses and psychiatric illnesses regulate neurotransmitters. But that's what glia do. That's their natural job. They surround the synapse, they pick up neurotransmitters, and they remove them. They also release neurotransmitters. So this will involve glia in information processing, things like learning and memory, but also in any disease involving transmission. So that's one aspect of disease, but there are many, many others.
And so how much research money is going into looking at the role of glial cells in combating illness?
This situation has changed. It's just exploded in the 4 years that I've been writing this book. And now there is a great deal of funding going into it. Half of the funding going into treating spinal cord injury, for example, is on glial research. It's so important. The other aspect of glia and disease is that glia are the first responders in any disease or injury. Perhaps I should say a little bit about the different kinds of glia, because some of these are particularly important in disease. There are four basic kinds of glia, but one of the important ones is called microglia. And the brain is isolated from the blood system because it's a very special environment. Substances don't readily cross into the brain from the bloodstream, and our immune cells can't penetrate into the brain in normal circumstances. So the brain has its own immune system, and that immune system is a type of glial cell called microglia. Now, that makes glial cells, and particularly microglia, central to every aspect of infection, disease, and injury. They're the first responders in stroke or any kind of injury to the brain. So we're talking about microglia. Let me give some specific examples then. Dementia is a very severe problem in HIV. The brain is severely affected, and the thing that most people don't realize is that HIV virus does not infect neurons. It infects glia. So that's an example of the importance of the other brain on normal brain function. So microglia are very important in that. Another good example of glia that have been overlooked in disease is chronic pain. Chronic pain is different from normal pain, the kind of pain that saves you from burning your finger on the stove. Chronic pain is very mysterious and has been difficult to treat because doctors really didn't understand it. This pain develops after an injury, and often even after the injury heals, you have a back injury, it gets better, but these people develop excruciating pain and become dependent on narcotic pain relievers. Well, the reason it was so hard to understand is that the other brain was being overlooked. We now know that after a painful injury, glial cells sense the firing of neural pathways involved in pain, and then they release substances that are important in healing, but they also increase the excitability of these pain circuits. So now the glia are releasing substances, cytokines, and other molecules that cause pain. That's okay in the early part of healing because you want to leave a tender injury alone so it'll heal. But if they don't stop releasing that substance, the pain doesn't go away. And these glia in the spinal cord and in the brain continue to excite these pain circuits and result in chronic pain. But realizing that glia are involved in pain and many other disorders is now allowing new treatments and new drugs, entire new types of drugs to treat pain that have nothing to do with the neurons or operate differently from the drugs directed at neurons.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. And so drugs that will basically stop glia from releasing substances?
Yes, the idea is either to stop them from releasing these compounds or to suppress their response to the neural signals that trigger the changes in glia. A good example there is marijuana, which is approved in many states for treatment of chronic pain that can't be controlled in any other way. And recent findings show that the receptors for the active ingredient in marijuana that relieve pain are on glia. They're not on neurons. So there are even new drugs now being used in other countries that are approved in Canada, for example, which are THC-derived drugs that will relieve pain by suppressing the response in glia.
So, Dr. Fields, one thing we really want to ask you about, because we've had a lot of guests that deal with issues of autism and epilepsy, brain fog, that kind of thing, and you are obviously the go-to expert on how the brain and this new discovery with the glial cells is functioning. What is going on with these just astronomically high rates of autism in our country?
Well, I think there's a lot of debate on autism, and I don't really have an answer for you except to say that autism is considered a complex disorder, but agreed to be a developmental disorder. And glia are key to development of the brain in the fetus. They actually guide the migration of neurons to the right place in the fetal brain. They form the connections between the appropriate neurons. They act as guideposts, and they stimulate the formation of synapses. So we think in disorders like autism and other developmental disorders, which include things like schizophrenia, which we understand now because the brain develops through childhood, that that's also a developmental disorder, that glia are involved in the disease in that way. There's a new dimension of glial involvement, another kind of glial cell that we haven't talked about, which are the kind of glia that make the electrical insulation on the axons. And you're familiar with this from multiple sclerosis, the myelin, which is electrical coating on axons. Without this coating, impulses will not travel long distances very fast, and communication can be disrupted, as you can see with someone with MS, can end up wheelchair bound. But this insulation increases the speed of impulse propagation through neural circuits 100 times. Well, new methods of imaging and also new gene arrays have revealed changes in these glial cells that make myelin in disorders from schizophrenia to autism. And in fact, in autism, there's too much myelin. So we're now beginning to realize that brain function depends critically on the propagation of impulses through circuits of the brain, where the flow of information has to be synchronous and well-timed. And the glial cells, by insulating the axons and regulating the conduction time, are involved in things like autism and schizophrenia.
And so how far out are we from having this research helping people recover from some of these illnesses?
Well, it's really happening now that people are appreciating the role of glia, and it's touching many different fields. Spinal cord injury is an example. If you injure a nerve in your arm or leg, it'll heal eventually. But if you have an injury in your spinal cord, you're paralyzed for life. And why is that? The same injury affects neurons in the brain and in the spinal cord differently. It turns out that glia are the reason for paralysis. Glia actually block the regeneration of these axons in several ways after they're cut. And one of the surprises was that there are proteins in this myelin sheath that I was just describing that block the regrowth of axons. And that was a big surprise. We can talk about why nature would have booby-trapped the brain so that it can't repair itself. But in direct response to your question, new drugs that block these proteins are being used right now in clinical trials to restore mobility. They're being used now in patients, and they definitely work in experimental animals. Another example is cancer. A lot of people may not realize that brain cancers have little to do with neurons. The brain cancer is caused by glial cells that are growing uncontrollably. Neurons, when they're mature, don't divide, so they're not in a position to become cancerous. Some of these cancers are very aggressive, like the glioblastoma that Senator Kennedy suffered is a very aggressive kind of glial cancer. And new drugs that are directed towards particular molecules on glia are being used right now to treat the kind of cancer that Senator Kennedy died from. And these are very effective, and this new treatment will allow the individual cells to be killed one at a time rather than having to have surgery and remove blocks of tissue and having cells escape the surgeon.
And you have a very touching description in The Other Brain about a colleague of yours or someone that was a physician that was at one of your lectures who had brain cancer and was trying to decide between radiation and chemotherapy and realizing that neither of those were great answers. So this provides some hope, it sounds like, with the treatment of glial cells.
Tremendous hope, and then also at the same time realizing how much catch-up we're playing because we dismissed this part of the brain so long, and we have so much to learn about glia. How many are there? What controls their cell division and whether they become cancerous or not? Another thing that we've just discovered, another indication of the revolution in science is causing is in the past, it was thought that neurons don't divide. Well, they are not born again in the adult brain, but the new research shows that things like exercise can promote the birth of new neurons in parts of the brain involved in memory, for example. And the mechanisms are being worked out. There are growth factors, which are factors that stimulate the growth of neurons and the birth of new neurons. And these cells that are stem-like cells in the adult brain, not fetal stem cells, but cells in the adult brain that respond to injury and to exercise, these are not neurons because neurons can't divide. These are immature glial cells. So if we can learn to control the stem cells that nature's already provided, we can begin to repair a lot of these diseases like Parkinson's, which is a disease involving the loss of a particular kind of neuron. So this is very exciting. In fact, transplant of a glial cell is being used now to treat spinal cord injury. It's the first approved study on humans of cell transplant to treat spinal cord injury, and they're using a type of immature glial cell for that work.
And one of the things you also say about brain cancer, it grows in the glial cells.
Well, let me back up and say, what is cancer? Cancer is uncontrolled cell division. The cell just starts to divide wildly. If you think about how important it is for cell division to be controlled so that our tissues maintain the constant shape and size despite the loss of cells throughout life. So this is a very tightly controlled process. But in cancer, cell division just runs amok. And because neurons don't divide, they don't become cancerous. But glial cells are dividing. They're stimulated to divide under certain circumstances, for example, after an injury, which explains why you can see a promotion of cancer after injury. In any case, the glial cells normal cell division and become cancerous.
I love the way you describe that, the failure of the brakes that stop cell division, and that the wayward glia are actual killers for brain cancer.
That's right. All types of glia are in a position to become cancerous because of that. There are some exceptions. There are some cells that line the brain, skin-like cells, that can become cancerous. But by and large, cancers of the brain are glial cancers.
One of the things we talk about quite a bit is the role of food and lifestyle in creating wellness. And what do you think about food? How important is this as far as an effect on the brain?
Well, I would say that all of those measures that we hear about to promote brain health and enriched environments and exercise and good diet and all of these things we're learning work through glia, by and large, because what is the source of these factors that nourish the neurons? Well, the source are glia. BDNF is one of them that I mentioned before, I believe, that's involved in stimulating the birth of new neurons. Glia provide the energy source for neurons. So they extract nutrients from the blood and provide them to neurons in proportion to neuronal demand. Another thing that we've just discovered in the last few years is that glia control the blood flow to the brain. And blood flow to the brain is very important for cognitive function. In fact, I know you've seen these fMRI images of the brain, these brain scans, where there'll be a little red spot saying, oh, this part of the brain is involved in this function. When they have a person do a certain task, it lights up. That technique isn't really looking at neural activity. It's looking at blood flow, which is very localized to those areas of the brain that have an increased need. And it turns out that a kind of glia called an astrocyte, because they look a bit like stars, regulate the local blood flow. They sense neural activity, increase neural demand, and then they release substances that cause the capillaries and vessels in the brain to dilate and bring more blood to that part of the brain. So I think every aspect of brain health is going to involve glial cells because they're the ones involved in all of these support functions that allow neurons to do their communication.
For more interviews with the world's top health and medical experts, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Dr. Fields, if there are a few things that you really want people to take away from your research and from this wonderful new book that you've written, The Other Brain, what would that be?
Well, I guess in addition to all the information, it is just the excitement of witnessing an emergence of a new dimension in brain function that is so exciting. So I'd like for the book to portray that in addition to all of the information that's so important. Just the excitement seen through the eyes of a neuroscientist watching it happen, to give an eyewitness view of that. So that's one of the things I'd really hope that people take away from this.
And you've really accomplished that. You have a wonderful sense of storytelling. It was a delightful read. And I know I emailed you that my 7-year-old overheard us talking about it and immediately was firing off questions, which, of course, I had to reread the book to answer. But it is delightfully written and very reader-friendly, so we appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
And so what do you see in the future for this research? What kind of things do you see happening?
Well, there's so many frontiers that are being advanced in different directions in glial research. In my own lab, we're most interested now in expanding our concept of learning, how the brain learns. In the past, all of our work is focused on the synapse, and I've studied memory and the mechanisms of memory for a long time, and synapses are very important. But now we're realizing that we have this communication that leaves neurons that's in glial cells, and it's moving us beyond the synapse to realize that glia can be involved in learning skills, for example, like learning to play the piano. We have brain imaging methods now that allow us to see changes in part of the brain called the white matter where neurons are absent. This is half the human brain, and it's composed of these connections between neurons. And after you learn to play a musical instrument or learn to juggle, these brain imaging methods are showing changes in these regions with learning. So I'm excited about just this aspect of brain function and learning that lies beyond neurons and even beyond synapses. At the same time, we're very interested in disease and in developments of the brain. We're working in those areas as well.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, Dr. Fields, about the learning, because that is something we did want to ask you about also. And, you know, a lot of our listeners have children with learning disabilities, and, you know, the rates of that in this country are phenomenal. I'm sure you're aware, 1 in 6 struggling with dyslexia or other learning struggles. What do you think is accounting for that?
Well, I think more and more of these things you could think of in terms of developmental disorders or maturation. Let's take a big view, the biological perspective on what the brain does. The brain allows us to cheat evolution in a way because our brains are evolved after we're born and takes 20 years to wire up a human brain. And it's wired up according to its environment. Your brain's different from mine because of the experiences we had and the schooling and our interests. And that gave our brain a certain structure, a wiring, and capabilities that are unique to us. And in a biological perspective, that gives in the environment we were born in instead of the caveman environment. That's what allows humans to excel, and it's the human brain's function to interact with the environment. So in terms of learning, I think things like dyslexia, definitely, you know, there's always this interaction between genes and environment, and there's little we can do about the genes right now, but we can intervene with the environment. Dyslexic children do learn to read. It takes them a long time, but there's new evidence to show that their brains can rewire in order to process information involved in reading. So I guess I'd like to get across that the human brain develops through the 20s, and part of this development is glial involvement in forming insulation on the nerve pathways. Once that insulation is formed, then new sprouting of new connections is suppressed. And that is the reason for the riddle that I mentioned earlier. Why did nature booby-trap the brain so that when there were proteins in myelin that block sprouts? The reason is that once your brain becomes adapted to the environment and learns according to the environment that you're in, you don't want to lose that. And so myelin stops sprouting. So to put it another way, we have the brains that we developed by the time you're about 20. You can learn new things after that, early 20s. But you'll never be world-class cellist if you take up cello at age 30, probably. You have to start young.
So are the glial cells involved in the learning disabilities, or is that something completely different?
No, the glial cells are involved in the learning disabilities because they regulate the development of the brain, the migration and the formation of the neurons, and the formation of synapses are controlled by glia. And this insulation of the fibers that allow high-speed impulse conduction through circuits involved in complex functions like reading. These are all glial processes.
Well, Dr. Fields, we want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to hearing more about your incredible research that you're doing at the NIH, and just recommend everybody pick up a copy of The Other Brain. Thank you so much, Dr. Fields.
Thank you very much, Chris.
That's the end of our interview with Dr. Douglas Fields, Ph.D. For more great interviews on brain science and brain training, go to Michael Senoff's WholeBrainPowerCoaching.com. That's www.WholeBrainPowerCoaching.com. Thanks for listening.